This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the truth is that as long as that conflict goes on and keeps spreading, we're just going to see a worsening hunger crisis. Fundamentally, what the people of South Sudan need is for this war to end.
That's Charles McDonough of the World Food Program talking about the humanitarian crisis in South Sudan. Details coming up.
Also, there's new warnings today about growing hunger in Ethiopia and an increased risk of famine in Somalia. Aid agencies say humanitarian efforts against hunger in northeast Nigeria are dangerously underfunded. And the daughter of Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe now heads the censorship board, known for banning films, documentaries, and art.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, there's a new warning that hunger will sharply increase in parts of Ethiopia in the coming months as the effects of poor rains and drought continue to take a toll. The U.S.-based Famine Early Warning System Network, or FEWS-NET, reports those in need of food aid will rise above the current level of 7.7 million people. Reuters quotes FEWS-NET as saying despite enhanced rainfall at the end of April into early May over many areas of Ethiopia, food security outcomes are still expected to deteriorate. It says herders in southeastern Ethiopia will be hit the hardest over the next 3 months. In fact, hunger in the region has reached the fourth of five emergency levels, with the fifth level considered to be famine.
There's also a warning today about the humanitarian crisis in Somalia, saying there's an elevated risk of famine. Drought and conflict are the main reasons. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says more than 2.5 million Somalis will be in crisis by next month, with 700,000 of them in emergency levels of food insecurity. Overall, 6.7 million Somalis need some kind of assistance. The FAO's Food Security and Nutrition Analysis Unit says the drought has more than doubled the number of children admitted to nutritional feeding centers in Baidoa and Kismayo compared to a year ago. What's more, cases of acute watery diarrhea, cholera, and measles are on the rise. More than 680,000 people in Somalia have been displaced by drought since last November. The $1.5 billion humanitarian response plan for Somalia this year is only about one-third funded.
The heads of the UN World Food Program and the Food and Agriculture Organization visited South Sudan this week, where 5.5 million people face severe hunger. David Beasley of the WFP and José Graziano da Silva of the FAO visited Unity State, where famine has been declared in two counties, affecting 90,000 people there. The two agencies have a combined funding gap of more than $180 million for their operations in South Sudan for the next 6 months. To learn more about the visit, VOA's Joe DiCapua spoke with World Food Program regional spokesperson Chalice McDonough.
They went to South Sudan because it is the most intense food crisis in the world right now. It is the only place on earth where famine has been declared and where people are literally in danger of starving to death. There are, however, three other countries in the world that are at risk of famine, and I think that their goal was to draw the world's attention to the fact that there are these enormous crises, there are many, many lives at stake, and it's absolutely vital that the world recognize the severity of those crises and that it is possible for us to roll back the famine, to stop the famine in South Sudan, to keep it from spreading to other areas, and to avert famine in the other countries where it's a danger. But it's going to take an enormous commitment from the international community to do that.
They paid a visit to Unity State, and of course, two counties in Unity State are the famine areas. Did they describe what they saw there?
They did, and it was really very moving. The first place that they stopped was in the very southern tip of Unity State, in a place called Ganyel, which is surrounded by swamps that have formed a natural barrier against fighting. So there are tens of thousands of people who have sought shelter there. And they saw a massive aid effort in Ganyel, airdrops of food from WFP, distributions of fishing kits and vegetable seeds from the Food and Agriculture Organization that have allowed people to survive. And so that area has not been declared in famine, but there is absolutely no doubt that if it weren't for that massive humanitarian response, it would be a famine there. So the work of WFP and FAO and UNICEF and a host of other agencies is what's basically keeping famine at bay in Ganyel. The second place that they stopped in Unity State was an island in the Nile surrounded by swamps called Cook Island. And that's a home to about 1,000 people who have sought shelter there from the fighting. It's not a place that's really accessible for food distribution, so we do assist the people there, but they have to walk about 3 hours to get to the next place that we can get a food distribution set up. So it's really a very dramatic situation. They saw children who are suffering from severe malnutrition. They're so undernourished that they're actually in danger of illness and death.
You touched on this, but would you explain how difficult it is to get these supplies to those in need?
It is one of the most complicated logistics operations in the world. We have to literally throw food out of the back of airplanes to reach some of these people. We have teams on the ground who are there to collect it. We've developed special systems using parachutes so that we can actually deliver vegetable oil that way. And that allows us to very quickly get a lot of food into a place for thousands of people. It costs us something like $1.5 million a day to mount our emergency relief operation in South Sudan. We use airplanes, we use boats and barges, we use every means that we have of getting assistance to people. In some places, there is food for sale in markets, but the prices have gotten so high because the economy is in collapse, and we can give people cash assistance and they can buy their own food in shops. But in other parts of the country, particularly in those famine areas, there just isn't any food available for people to buy unless we get it there.
Chalice, what's the outlook for agriculture in South Sudan? Any encouraging news about upcoming harvests?
I think we're very worried about the next agricultural season, in part because the fighting has actually spread to other areas of the country. So over the last year, in some areas of the southern part of the country and the equatorias, it's really considered the breadbasket of South Sudan and where most of the agricultural production comes from. A lot of those areas are actually seeing fighting now that wasn't happening before, and that's going to be an enormous challenge for farmers. We're hearing that people have not been able to cultivate their crops in places where we would normally rely on that. It's a troubling development for the hunger crisis in parts of the country where that hasn't really been an issue up until this last year. So unfortunately, I think the truth is that as long as that conflict goes on and keeps spreading, we're just going to see a worsening hunger crisis. Fundamentally, what the people of South Sudan need is for this war to end.
The World Food Program regional spokesperson Chalice McDonough. From Nairobi, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Aid agencies warn that humanitarian efforts against hunger in northeastern Nigeria are dangerously underfunded, and some communities remain cut off from aid and their farms as the military continues to battle Boko Haram. For VOA, Chika Adua reports from Abuja.
Communities in northeastern Nigeria are facing the dual threats of hunger and the terrorist group known as Boko Haram. The zone has been identified by aid agencies as one of four conflict-torn parts of the world at risk of famine this year. The United Nations Children's Fund estimates that the number of children suffering from severe acute malnutrition will reach 450,000 this year in the states of Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe. Scott Paul, a senior humanitarian policy advisor for the international charity organization Oxfam America, was recently in northeastern Nigeria. He says the biggest driver for the humanitarian emergency is the inability for residents to access their farmlands, fishing sites, and the markets.
I spoke with people who not able to go even a kilometer outside of town to farm. Right now, people are coming home sometimes under false pretenses. They're being told that their homeland is, that their home areas are safe. And they're coming home to find that the towns themselves might be safe, but the farmlands outside aren't safe. The markets aren't safe. The roads in and out of town aren't safe. And in some areas that we're working, there isn't even clean and safe water to be procured.
Nigeria's National Emergency Management Agency says people internally displaced by the conflict can voluntarily go back to liberated areas as long as they feel safe. The Nigerian Army provides road escorts several times a week from Maiduguri to certain communities. But aid groups say many communities are simply not prepared for the large numbers of people coming back. The Norwegian Refugee Council noted that more than 1 million people have returned to northeast Nigeria since October 2015, and they are returning to towns that have no basic services or infrastructure. Nearly 1 million homes were destroyed or damaged by years of fighting, according to Borno State Governor Kashim Shettima. Earlier this month, Shettima told reporters it is still not safe for many internally displaced people to return to their homes. The governor said the IDP camps will remain open indefinitely, but that he hopes Borno State will be safe enough for full rehabilitation very soon. The state capital, Maiduguri, is home to more than a dozen camps for those displaced by Boko Haram. Those camps have repeatedly been targeted by suicide bombings. Recently, 4 IDPs who had ventured outside one of the largest camps in Maiduguri to go hunting were killed by Boko Haram, an official from a state-sanctioned vigilante group told VOA. Their decapitated bodies were found along a major road. 2 weeks ago, Boko Haram insurgents killed at least 6 villagers who were working on their farmlands in a community just about 16 kilometers outside of Maiduguri. The fighters attacked the farmers as they prepared their fields for the rainy season. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari said in December Boko Haram had been crushed, but the military says mopping up operations are still underway. The unpredictability of the security situation is hampering food aid. The UN World Food Program is delivering food to communities by road under military escort, but says there are still areas it cannot access due to active fighting. And humanitarian response efforts remain critically underfunded. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says it has only received 23% of the $1.1 billion needed this year for Nigeria. The World Food Program warns that lean season has begun, with the next harvest not expected until September. The WFP says inadequate funding means it will not be able to reach about a quarter of the nearly 2 million people in northeast Nigeria that it had planned to assist in June. In its latest report, the International Crisis Group says failure to respond to the growing food emergency could have long-term security implications. VOA spoke to ICG's Nigeria researcher Nnamdi Obasi. Aid agencies are calling for urgent donor support and the government to ensure that communities are safe enough for returnees to resume fishing, farming, and market activities before the IDPs go home. Chika Odua for VOA News in Abuja.
19 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A new study says cleaning up air pollution in the U.S. could mean more rainfall in parts of Africa. The findings published in the Journal of Geophysical Research Atmospheres suggest that eliminating sulfur dioxide, a toxic gas, in the United States will increase rainfall in semi-arid Sahel.
Dan Westerfeld is an atmospheric chemist at the Columbia University's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory and the lead author of the report. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips about the research.
So the major source is coal-fired power plants. So, you know, where we get a lot of our electricity from in this country. This causes premature death, premature mortality from both cardiovascular disease, lung disease, all kinds of different undesirable outcomes.
And what you found is that there's confidently predict a specific correlation between a reduction in sulfur dioxide and an increased amount of rainfall and precipitation all the way in Africa.
We assumed we would reduce sulfur dioxide all the way to roughly zero, which is projected to happen by about 2100 in the United States, so the end of this century. And if that happens, we found that precipitation in the Sahel would increase by about 10% from its present day levels.
Now, how does that work?
It has to do with sort of changing the heat distribution in the atmosphere. Basically, the entire atmosphere is really interconnected. And these air pollution emissions from sulfur dioxide, they have a cooling effect on the surface of the planet. And they, in turn, also change the energy distribution or the heat distribution from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere. So if you reduce the sulfur dioxide, you reduce that cooling effect, you increase your warming over the U.S., over the northern hemisphere in general. And so that is what increases the rainfall in the Sahel. And so what you have is this energy imbalance between the northern and the southern hemisphere. This energy distribution is really what drives the global precipitation. And so when the two hemispheres are out of balance like that, the Earth wants to get things back into equilibrium or things back into balance. And to do that, it has to redistribute some of the heat. And when it does that, it ends up pushing up the tropical rain belt northward, further up into the northern hemisphere and more into the path of the Sahel, maybe even extends it into a later time of year than normally would be there. And it also intensifies the amount of rain in that rain belt. And so when you do change your sulfur dioxide over the U.S., you're basically shifting your tropical rain belt a little bit. And in the tropical rain belt, all of the Sahel's rain can be tied to that, the location of that tropical rain belt.
So this is really good news, right? Because Sahel is very vulnerable. There's been a lot of droughts and famines there.
Yeah, and the good news is that it makes sense to sort of control sulfur dioxide in the United States for human health-related issues in the U.S. You know, it's not something we want people breathing in. So it's sort of like a side benefit, almost, of having this extra rainfall in the Sahel from something that we should do anyway. It's kind of a win-win situation, I'd say.
That was Dan Westerfeld, an atmospheric chemist at Columbia University's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
The 27-year-old daughter of Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe will help decide what the public can watch on TV. The Associated Press reports Bona Mugabe has been appointed to the censorship board known for banning films, documentaries, and art. AP says the current chairman of the censorship board is a 78-year-old former cabinet minister who's been accused by his son of using blood rituals to bewitch the family. The case is currently in court.
OPEC, the Organization of Oil Exporting Countries, will continue to cut back on production until March of 2018. Reuters reports OPEC will keep production lower because there is still an oil glut on the world market. Reducing production has helped push the price for a barrel of crude oil to above $50 a barrel. That allows producers to make some profit.
Improving the productivity of small-scale farmers was the subject of a four-day workshop this week in Uganda. The International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD, and the Ugandan government brought policymakers and development experts together in Kampala. The workshop reviewed IFAD-funded projects and looked at ways to improve the productivity. Sana Jata is the organization's regional director for Eastern and Southern Africa. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle about IFAD's goals, which include improving financial support to farmers.
We focus on poor people, and often those poor people don't have access to a technology. They don't have access to the information for which they can be able to produce their products. So IFPAT's role is to give them those technologies, but also we give them the rural financial services to include even those poor people who are bypassed by the banking sector. This is what we call the missing middle. Sectors which are needing small amounts of money, between $500,000 for a company. So we're not talking about big enterprises, but small enterprises, small farmer groups that are able to increase the food availability in the rural areas.
Why don't small farmers have access to finance?
There are big risks for a bank who will give money to a small farmer to produce rice or potatoes or sugarcane. There are risks if the climate doesn't play ball. I mean, if there is a drought or there are over floods, the whole crop fails. Therefore, no bank or very few banks are willing to go and give those farming communities the financial resources they need. Therefore, the IFPAT function is to give them the capacity to become a good player. We give them technologies like crop varieties that can adapt to drought or they can adapt to floods. Then we also give them the technology to be able to produce by, for example, irrigation schemes. So that's how we make them attractive so that the banks can start looking at them as potential clients.
In terms of financing, what is the role of the government?
The government makes sure there are proper regulations that will secure both the banking sector and anybody who wants to do any microfinance services. The government makes sure there is proper supervision for those kinds of institutions that will be providing resources and finance to the farmers. But also government sometimes also strengthen to capitalize some of their own regional banks or their national banks to give them more resources and protect them and guarantees. They can provide guarantees. And once they are able to capitalize them and the banking sector has the right regulations, they can start probably be, let's say, reaching out to their clients and becoming self-sustaining after a number of years in that manner. The government also make it easy for institutions like IFAD to be able to help the smallholder so that the smallholder can become a good client for the banks and for the rural financial services.
Today, parts of Africa are experiencing drought and hunger and the risk of famine caused in part by climate change. Are there any examples of where improved finance has transformed at-risk areas into ones that can withstand the stress of drought or flooding?
Yes, we do have a big role to play. In fact, we have a facility, ASAP, Agricultural Smallholder Adaptation Program, where we are using climate smart technology by giving the right type of crops that can be adapting to the climate change. We also have ongoing projects where we use our projects to redesign and adapt to the climate change that happens. For example, in Malawi, we have a massive drought, or even I'm just coming from Lesotho, which had been suffering in 2015 from a lot of drought. And then suddenly there was also the La Nina, that was a lot of floods that came afterwards. So what happened was our projects were able to give them the technology that they will be able to introduce new cropping varieties for maize. That will be a different type of maize that can adapt to these changes in climate. But we also can give them, through the financial facility, to do some restocking. For example, in 2015, a lot of livestock was lost in Lesotho, but our projects are able to provide some financing to be able to restock their mohair goats and sheep that have been lost, and sometimes even big livestock like cattle. So our projects are geared towards specifically looking at climate change. Through this ASAP, we have, IFAD was able to mobilize about $300 million globally to be able to provide this kind of very targeted technology support for areas which are affected by drought and desertification or by flooding as a result of this climate change.
That was Sana Jata of the International Fund for Agricultural Development. He spoke to VOA's William Eagle. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa. On the next, Straight Talk Africa, a look at the life and journey of Mzee Boniface Byanyima, arguably one of Africa's most unique and remarkable teachers. The political icon died on May 16th at age 97. A discussion on Uganda's political giant. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.